Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush met the press yesterday in an Oval Office one-on-one with Tim Russert, host of NBC's Sunday morning program Meet the Press. The president defended his economic record, his service in the National Guard, and his decision to go to war in Iraq. The interview effectively kicked off Bush's reelection bid, and perhaps not a moment too soon, a Newsweek poll out this weekend shows that if the election were held today, Democratic frontrunner John Kerry would take 50% of the vote to President Bush's 45%. Tonight on Point, the president goes mano a mano with Tim Russert. What did we learn? What did you make of the president's performance on Meet the Press? Did President Bush gain by inviting in TV cameras to the Oval Office? Did he get asked the tough questions, your questions? Is he in fighting form for the upcoming campaign? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is James Pinkerton, columnist for Newsday.com, a Fox News contributor and former White House aide to Presidents Reagan and the first President Bush. Good evening and welcome, James Pinkerton.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Washington is Bob Summerby, editor of the DailyHowler.com, a website that critiques America's political press corps. Good evening and welcome, Bob Summerby.
Good evening.
Before we get started, Bob, James, let's listen to a clip of yesterday's Meet the Press interview. Here, Tim Russert asks President Bush how he responds to critics who say the U.S. was brought to war in Iraq under false pretenses.
The night you took the country to war, March 17th, you said this. Intelligence gathered by this and other governments leaves no doubt that the Iraq regime continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised.
Right.
That apparently is not the case.
Correct.
How do you respond to critics who say that you brought the nation to war under false pretenses?
Yes. First of all, I expected to find the weapons. Sitting behind this desk, making a very difficult decision of war and peace, and I based my decision on the best intelligence possible, intelligence that had been gathered over the years, intelligence that not only our analysts thought was valid, but analysts from other countries thought was valid. And I made a decision based upon that intelligence in the context of the war against terror. In other words, we were attacked, and therefore every threat had to be reanalyzed. Every threat had to be looked at. Every potential harm to America had to be judged in the context of this war on terror. And I made the decision, obviously, to take our case to the international community in the hopes that we could do this, achieve a disarmament of Saddam Hussein peacefully. In other words, we looked at the intelligence and we remembered the fact that he had used weapons, which meant he had had weapons. We knew the fact that he was paying for suicide bombers. We knew the fact that he was funding terrorist groups. In other words, he was a dangerous man. And that was the intelligence I was using prior to the run-up to this war.
President George W. Bush talking, broadcast on Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press with host Tim Russert. James Pinkerton, you've been an aide to President Reagan, to the first President Bush. I'm sure you watched with rapt attention yesterday. What did you see in this back and forth in the Oval Office? Did the president do himself some good here or not?
And for the overall hour or just on that part?
Well, let's look at the overall hour. I mean, this is the heart of it. He said, I am a wartime president. I'm a war president. But overall, did it work out for the president?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, Bush, who I first met in 1984 when he was just floating around the oil business in Texas, working very part-time in the general operation of his father, the then Vice President Bush, has gotten much better at answering questions. Russert would ask him a question about what the temperature is, and the president would say, well, Tim, let me tell you about the weather a little bit and explain that to you some. And I think he also was effective in terms of making sure that he got his answers out. He didn't let himself get cut off. Some might say he was filibustering, but I think he probably helped himself some with an admittedly shrinking percentage of the population that is strongly supportive of him. And he sort of, I think, put the Democrats the opposition on notice that he's prepared to make this case, he's prepared to take it out there. I think the country is in a curious state of tension about, there's a certain amount of suspicion about the Iraq war, and I actually was opposed to it myself from the get-go. But on the other hand, there's so much going on out there in terms of fear about more terror and more attacks and so on, that I don't think the American people are quite yet ready to cut the cord with him. And of course, of all the people to attack Bush on the Iraq war, the likely Democratic nominee, John Kerry, is in sort of a poor position, having voted with Bush and having, in effect, endorsed the intelligence findings of the CIA, which are now under question. Mm-hmm. So while Howard Dean, for example, might have been able to take the case to Bush directly, Kerry's in a much tougher spot.
Of course, John Kerry says, and will no doubt say again, that he did it all wrong, and the Democratic candidates were out very critical today of Bush's remarks yesterday. But James Pinkerton, there were Republicans scratching their heads today, too. Peggy Noonan, not very complimentary of the president's performance, called it not impressive. Rush Limbaugh today, acknowledging on his show that the conservatives all over the country were upset with Bush that he hadn't been more aggressive, more assertive. Is he getting some head-scratching from his own camp here?
No question he is. I read Peggy's article, and I noted that she said from now on Bush should give fewer interviews and more speeches. And actually then she said, of course, John Kerry should give more speeches, more interviews and fewer speeches. Look, there's no question that this has been a bad month for Bush. He's lost about 10 points in a lot of the polls. He's fallen behind Kerry in the head-to-heads. You know, he's got a problem here. There's no two ways around it.
Bob Summerby, did the American press, in the person of Tim Russert, take it to the president with the vigor that they ought, given how rarely he has made himself available for this kind of one-on-one interview?
No, they did not, in the person of Tim Russert, although they began this morning insisting that the bulldog Russert had gone after the president tooth and nail. What we heard in that answer that you played is one of a number of long, meandering answers. Jim called them filibusters. I couldn't blame the president for filibustering. At times, it seemed Russert had simply left the room. He let Bush go on so long with his answers. Long, meandering answers to remarkably vague questions. The question you picked out there, the topic you picked out, is the topic that Americans, I presume, are wondering about. They're wondering, was the intelligence bad, or was reasonably nuanced intelligence exaggerated by the Bush administration? Mm-hmm. I can't exactly tell you the answer to that, but Russert raised, there are certainly a number of specific areas where the administration seems to have exaggerated. Russert raised no specifics. He made no attempt to follow up. Bush instantly changed the subject on him when he raised the question. It was a very weak interview by Russert, and we didn't learn very much as a result.
Tom Shales in the Washington Post this morning describes it differently. He said this is a relentless inquisitor, bore down on his victim, i.e. the president.
They will all describe it differently. They have a script about Russert. It's written in stone within the press corps. They will all tell you he's the bulldog who won't let anyone go. Shales compared him to the old Perry Mason. Russert sometimes does conduct interviews that way. Sometimes he goes way too far in that direction, but he clearly did not yesterday, and I'm going to be discussing that on the Daily Howler all week with examples. It was a very, very softball interview.
We'll look at some more of that. Let's hear a little bit more from the interview. This was a kind of follow-up, if I remember the sequence correctly, here asking Bush if he was wrong to imply that there was no doubt about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction.
Mr. President, the director of the CIA said that his briefings had qualifiers and caveats, but when you spoke to the country, you said there is no doubt. When Vice President Cheney spoke to the country, he said it's no doubt. Secretary Powell, no doubt. Secretary Rumsfeld, no doubt we know where the weapons are. You said, the Iraqi regime is a threat of unique urgency. Saddam Hussein is a threat that you must deal with as quickly as possible. You gave the clear sense that this was an immediate threat that must be dealt with.
I think, if I might, remind you that in my language, I call it a grave and gathering threat. But I don't want to get in the word contest, but what I do want to share with you my sentiment at the time. There was no doubt in my mind that Saddam Hussein was a danger to America.
In what way?
No doubt. Well, because he had the capacity to have a weapon, make a weapon. We thought he had weapons. the international community thought he had weapons, but he had the capacity to make a weapon, and then let that weapon fall into the hands of a shadowy terrorist network. It's important for people to understand the context in which I made a decision here in the Oval Office. I'm dealing with a world in which we have gotten struck by terrorists with airplanes, and we get intelligence saying that we want to harm America. And the worst nightmare scenario for any president is to realize that these kind of terrorist networks have the capacity to arm up with some of these deadly weapons and then strike us. And the president of the United States' most solemn responsibility is to keep his country secure. And the man was a threat. And we dealt with him. And we dealt with him because we cannot hope for the best.
Tim Russert, again, with the president, broadcast yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press. James Pinkerton, a lot to look at here. One angle we need to go back to is Bob Summerbee's on whether or not Russert was sufficiently aggressive. But also, here's the line from President Bush, that the president has to be the stand-up guy. He must be the wartime president. It's thrust upon him. And yet, in the context of his response right there, he talks about Saddam Hussein's capacity, presumably weapons to create weapons of mass destruction. And I found myself wondering as I listened yesterday if that in itself was not a new kind of exaggeration. Did David Kaye, the chief weapons inspector, really say that Saddam Hussein had that capacity? I thought he said he had the potential to possibly have a program that could get toward those weapons, but not the capacity.
Well, I'm neither a Jesuit nor a rabbi, so I'm not qualified to exactly figure out those terms. Because I agree, there is
they're important, are they not?
A certain, of course, there is. There's important. Here's a reaction, though, and that is there. Some ways there are sort of two modes of thinking about the word stand up, and I on the issue of credibility in terms of does what Bush is saying now match with what he was saying a year ago, and of course, does what he was saying a year ago match the reality in Iraq? I think that's extremely open to question. Your original query to me was how did this play sort of in the country and so on, and I think that leads to the second definition of stand-up, if I could, which is he a decisive fellow? And I think that's where Bush is still in pretty good shape. I mean, people will say, yes, there's a certain amount of murkiness associated with the Iraq war, and again, I opposed it. But I get the feeling, and even including among many Democrats, that they are in great fear from a political point of view, as well as from a just general national point of view, of future attacks. I mean, we saw over the weekend all this stuff about Pakistan and loose
nuclear technology.
And an Israeli newspaper had reports that Al-Qaeda had bought tactical nuclear weapons from the Ukraine back in 1998. Now, I don't know why they didn't use them in Afghanistan, but nonetheless, there's so much concern and fear about just all these threats that nobody really has a handle on, that in that sense, Bush's perception of being a stand-up guy in terms of, well would he take decisive action, I think appeals to a great many people and frankly makes the Democrats nervous because they're afraid of looking, look at Howard Dean. Howard Dean was sort of totally opposed to, the Iraq war and to Bush's general hawkish policy.
And look where he stands now.
Exactly.
Bob Summerbee, a couple of threads there. First on Tim Russert. I mean, here he was. He was coming in with a multi-layered question going at the president on this issue of credibility. Was that not tough enough for you?
Well, not really, because there are a number of specific areas in the discussion leading up to the war in which it does seem fairly clear, and some fairly good reporting has been done 8 months ago by the New Republic, for example, suggesting that administration figures clearly misstated what was in the intelligence. The aluminum tubes was something that was discussed endlessly in the fall of 2002. Condoleezza Rice went on TV, said there's no conceivable use for them except for nukes. That seems to have clearly been false. And that was as specific as Russert got, what we heard there, when he said, well, a bunch of you said there was no doubt. The problem I have with Bush's performance yesterday, and I'm sympathetic to his concerns about safety, and I think Democrats have to say that we are going to keep you safe. Democrats cannot sit around like this is not a serious, serious concern. The trouble with Bush's performance is he seems to have no concern about what happened to the intelligence. Early on, he floated the talking point in the interview without being asked that George Tenet's doing a great job and he's going to stay on as CIA head.
Yep, no question.
Russert didn't follow up at all. That's a very odd thing to say. The CIA clearly there was some kind of intelligence failure with 9/11, some kind of failure with Iraq.
Bob Summerby, James Pinkerton, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about the president on Meet the Press yesterday and how he did. We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the president on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday and how he did, how Tim Russert, host of Meet the Press, did for that matter. You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Did President Bush gain by inviting in the TV camera? Did Tim Russert ask the tough questions, your questions? Was Russert as tough on Bush as he's been on the Democratic candidates? Did the president appear in command of the issues? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight by Jim Pinkerton, columnist at Newsday.com, Fox News contributor and former White House aide to Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and by Bob Summerby, editor of the blog TheDailyHowler.com. John is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you tonight?
Great, thanks.
Good. And watching this interview yesterday, it got me wondering about the process of how such an interview with the president comes about. As one of your guests pointed out, that there were almost no follow-up questions asked by Tim Russert to the president. And in sitting there watching it, I'm saying to myself, okay, ask him this, ask him this.
Yeah.
This, a list of five or six, follow-up questions that I have in my head. No doubt Tim Russert, has that list of questions as well.
what I wonder is,
in an hour interview like this, it's very difficult for any journalist to get access to this president in particular. If you or your guests could shed some light on, is there a format set up ahead of time as to how such a session will take place?
Yeah, that's a great question.
As journalists,
is there an etiquette here, a protocol, a format even?
How would you feel about being in this position interviewing the president? What effect does that have on somebody like Tim Russert?
Great questions all, John. Let us pick them up, and thank you for your call. Bob Summerby, first of all, do we know whether or not there were pre-agreed questions here? Had President Bush been given a list of questions? Is that public?
Well, if he was, he didn't go over them very carefully. Russert discussed some of this morning on the IMA show. He discussed what it's like to interview in the White House, and he said he called his father, Big Russ, up in Buffalo, and Big Russ told him, don't forget, Tim, you'll be in your job longer than the president is in his. I don't know how he knows that.
And what does that mean? What does that suggest?
But then he also said, but Tim, the office of the president will be there longer than you're in your job. And that suggests that Russert went into the White House and adopted a different tone toward this interview subject than he has done with other candidates, the Democratic. And clearly this was in no way comparable to the hectoring, lecturing, scolding session he had with Howard Dean last June.
We had the
sessions. And it's just unfortunate because I think the happy medium is somewhere in between. He really rolled over yesterday. And he has, at times in the past, lectured candidates, and he just has to find a happy medium. I'm in favor of respect for a president, but you can't have one set of candidates being lectured and one set being handled with kid gloves.
James Pinkerton, how about it? Is there an etiquette, a protocol that a journalist sitting in the White House one-on-one with the president needs to observe that he might not observe with a challenger who might one day sit in the White House or not?
Well, I agree with Bob, and by the way, I'm a big fan of his website. Daily Howler is definitely a must-read.
There you go, Jim.
Down here in D.C. But there's also so I agree with all that's been said so far, and I even agree that Russert was much tougher on Howard Dean. And I don't really see why there should be a distinction between two guys who want to be president or elected president in 2004, Howard Dean, who probably won't make it, and Bush, who may well. There's another element as well, just in terms of how these things get figured out. There are, I guess, major interview shows on Sunday, the three networks plus Fox,
yep,
plus CNN. Mm. So for Bush to pick Russert was, they said, because we respect him so much and so on. Well, that's all nice. But Russert knew that he was getting a huge gift. He is even more than usual, he is the top dog, the numero uno of, Sunday talk show hosts. And if he'd gone in there and savaged Bush, as he did to Dean, he probably wouldn't get another one. And that's not a small concern for these people.
Because access matters, and access to the Oval Office is the ultimate access.
Exactly.
Well, there it is. Etiquette or not, it's a market kind of dynamic. And Bob?
Yeah, I will say this. Russert clearly savaged Vice President Gore in July 2000 when Gore was in the vice presidential mansion. That was one of his most objectionable interviews, Russert's, and it's just it's a troubling failure to find a happy medium that I thought we were all poorly served by yesterday.
Well, Bob Somerby, thanks so much for your comments and for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Bob Somerby, editor of the blog thedailyhowler.com. Joining us now from Washington is Kellyanne Conway. She's a Republican pollster, president and CEO of The Polling Company. Good evening and welcome, Kellyanne Conway.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Thanks for being with us, Kellyanne. You watched the president, no doubt. What did you make of it? And more than that, are there polls that say what Americans, what Republicans made of his interview yesterday?
Unfortunately, there's a paucity of information that really gets to those who actually watch the interview. We all pretend that we're so important, those in the political class, that the rest of the country does as we do on Sunday mornings and actually is glued to the TV and watches this. It's not as watched
but in
an
fact,
event.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as watched an event as, say, the State of the Union or even a prime time impromptu mm-hmm. presidential press conference by any president, this or any other prior to him. But I will say this. There are a bunch of polls out this week and really being released on Sunday and Monday that I must, in the interest of the listeners, give some caution to. For example, the Newsweek poll, notoriously off when compared to other media polls.
This is the 50% to Kerry, 45% to Bush, hypothetically.
Yeah, hypothetically. Here are just a couple things we should look at when we look at the polls. The Newsweek poll just insists, for some reason, unlike other polls, on serving people on Friday nights. I mean, I've been in polling for this is my 16th year, and you just don't survey on Friday nights.
So how does that warp the poll? Are you saying it does? In what direction?
Pardon me?
Does that warp the response in some way?
Well, what it doesn't allow the poll to breathe over a sufficient number of nights and allow certain demographics an equal opportunity to be surveyed, because there simply are not certain classes of people as often at home on a Friday night as there are other people, frankly.
I guess Newsweek wants it fresh before they go to bed on Saturday, Sunday.
Well, you know, even polling just on a weekend is difficult unless you have a special circumstance. Actually, Sunday nights are a good time to survey.
But take us to Bush with Meet the Press. What did you think of the performance, Kellyanne?
Okay, well, if you're asking me to be an Olympian judge and not a pollster, I could pull out my numbers and I can say I'd give him somewhere of a 9.1. He gets but he's being the president. He's not a presidential candidate. He's not up for a Grammy Award against Beyoncé Knowles, and he certainly isn't begging the French judge to give him a perfect 10.
What are you suggesting by that?
What I'm suggesting by that is that even any of us trying to assess a president's performance, whether it's Bill Clinton before the grand jury on August 17, 1998, or George W. Bush yesterday in Meet the Press, when you're assessing the performance rather than how comfortable and trustful we all feel about that particular president, I think we're doing the president, whoever he is, and ourselves a disservice. What I thought was that it took an awful lot of courage to go one-on-one with Tim Russert to begin with. And I'll tell you what, I think people are tired of the topic. That's the unfortunate part.
The war? Which topic? The war, the economy, his military service, what?
Well, really just the entire war. I mean, we tire of things very quickly in this country. And unfortunately, it's been almost a year since the president, on May 1st, 2003, stood up and said, you know, major combat operations are over, mission accomplished, and we kind of crossed it off our to-do list.
So when he bases his appearance there on being a war president, are you saying that doesn't work or not?
I don't understand the question. I'm sorry.
Well, you're saying people are tired of talking about the war, and yet President Bush, in his interview with Tim Russert, made that the central pillar of his...
And that's precisely what I'm saying. I think the unfortunate part is that the president has staked his presidency, do or die, on an issue that the country seems to now feel fatigue about. They kind of want to move on to other things, and it does obscure some of the other accomplishments that he would like to stake as part of his legacy, namely prescription drug benefit, the fact that tax cuts were passed twice and that people seem to be enjoying the benefits of those. It's helping to spur the economy. All of that gets obscured by war talk. And he, as Commander-in-Chief, has made very clear that he is going to see this mission through. He'd like to have another 4 years to do it. But I think we're missing a fundamental point, that people in this country are tired of having replaced the she cluster of issues, Social Security, health care, and education, with the we cluster, war and the economy. Plus, the Newsweek poll is of adults. And the last time I checked, likely voters, not just registered voters, let alone adults, are the ones who cast the ballots. You also need to look at the number, finally, of the number of people who have an opinion of both Bush and Kerry, and then look at the head-to-head balloting that way. The President of the United States has a 100% name ID in this country. John Kerry does not.
Let's shift off the Newsweek poll for a minute and get back to Meet the Press. Let's shift off the war, as you suggest, and listen to this exchange around the economy.
The unemployment rate has gone up 33%. There's been a loss of 2.2 million jobs. We've gone from a $281 billion surplus to a $521 billion deficit. The debt has gone from $5.7 trillion to $7 trillion, up 23%. Based on that record, why should the American people rehire you as CEO?
Sure. Because I have been the president during a time of tremendous stress on our economy, and made the decisions necessary to lead that will enhance recovery. Let me review the bidding here. The stock market started to decline in March of 2000. That was the first signs that things were troubled. The recession started upon my arrival. You know, it could have been, some say February, some say March, some speculate maybe earlier it started, but nevertheless, it happened as we showed up here. The attacks on our country affected our economy. Corporate scandals affected the confidence of people and therefore affected the economy. My decision on Iraq, this kind of march to war, affected the economy. We've been through a lot, and what those numbers show is the fact we have been through a lot. But what the people must understand is that instead of wondering what to do, I acted, and I acted by cutting the taxes on individuals and small businesses primarily. And that itself has led to this recovery.
The president says he acted in response to a question from Meet the Press, NBC Meet the Press host Tim Russert there. I want to welcome into our conversation Joshua Micah Marshall. He joins us from Washington. He's a contributing writer to Washington Monthly Magazine and author of the daily blog TalkingPointsMemo.com. Good evening and welcome, Josh Marshall.
Thanks so much.
You heard the president's clip right there, Tim Russert saying, statistics, statistics, statistic, why should the American public rehire you as CEO? What did you make of the president's response? Tax cuts.
Well, I think what the president's remarks showed is that if Kellyanne is right and the president or takes her advice and the president tries to contest this next election by putting foreign policy to the side, he's toast. I mean, it's completely over.
I mean, if he turns to the economy, it doesn't get better; it gets worse.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any question. I mean, the economy is certainly on the upswing, but it's not even as good as it looked a couple months ago. Job creation is still lacking. The deficit is huge. So, I mean, there is one way the president is going to win this election, and it's not at all unlikely, and that is his credibility on foreign policy as the defender of the nation in a time of war and terrorism of various varieties. So, you know, what I said in a piece I wrote about this yesterday is the reason I think, and I think it's sort of a consensus, that the president did not have a particularly good interview yesterday, and I think even Kellyanne sort of admitted that, even if obliquely, is that the facts aren't really on his side at the moment, and it's not it's hard to go into an hour long interview if the data points aren't pointing in your direction. The other point I just have to say about Kellyanne's points about the Newsweek poll, you know, every poll can be critiqued by another pollster, but there have been four or five polls out in the last 10 days or so. And they all show pretty much what the Newsweek poll says, so I don't think you can really second-guess the general verdict.
Fair enough. I don't want to get caught up in the poll surrounding the interview yesterday, but let's stay on the interview, and a lot of callers want to join us. Steven's calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Steven. You're on the air.
Yeah, I suffered through that interview, and I'm with Kevin Phillips. He called this guy a national embarrassment. I think the rest of the world, looking at this clown, is just saying, what's gotten to the heads of the American people that we go for this lowest common denominator? It's embarrassing to see this.
What's embarrassing exactly, Stephen? What's embarrassing exactly?
His prevarications. They're trying to get him to adopt this tough guy pose. It's like relying on fear. He's trying to sell fear, and what I'm afraid of is they're going to permit another 9/11 before November in order to prey on the fears of especially the soft southern-headed end-of-the-world types.
So here's an American citizen not persuaded by the interview yesterday. James Pinkerton, how about this issue of credibility and selling fear? What's your read on the electorate broadly? How do you think it's going to break down? How much of the American population is open to this war president, I've got credibility, I'm going to protect you, versus this cynicism we hear, or suspicion, I should say, that it's just selling fear?
Frankly, it reminds me a lot, not that I was alive at the time, but of the concern about the Pearl Harbor, which eddied around through the body politic for many, many years after December 7th, 1941. President Roosevelt obviously was a Democrat. The Republicans, many of them, including in high places in Washington, were saying, look, Franklin Roosevelt brought this on. This is a plot by Roosevelt working with Winston Churchill or whoever to get the Japanese to attack us, and it became a major focus of attention. I think the last official investigation of Pearl Harbor ended in 1995.
But you don't hear that much second-guessing of 9/11. That's not the fear we're talking about, is it?
I think the caller just suggested that Bush would bring in another 9/11 to help him get reelected, a kind of a wag-the-dog scenario. I think that there's a lot of that. Feeling out there that Bush was either very derelict or perhaps complicit in something on this, and that there will be more attacks coming. I think what 9/11 certainly did was convince Americans that this is an extremely dangerous world. And in times like that, there's a certain default to strong leaders who maybe arguably shoot first before there's even a probable cause. But nonetheless, this is a fairly hawkish country, and if there's an election in American history between a hawk and a dove, and I can think of three, 1864, with his Lincoln versus McClellan, and 1940, which was Roosevelt versus Wilkie,
yep.
And 1972, which was Nixon versus McGovern, the hawks win and the doves lose.
Kellyanne Conway, how about it? We've just got a minute before the break. You're saying Americans are tired of war, but Jim Pinkerton's saying, well, hawks win.
Whether they're tired or not, the president has said that he's going to continue to be commander-in-chief and stake his legacy on the war. And the fact is that if you're looking at a poll, just make sure, and everybody loves to run around and repeat them and then doesn't want to talk about them. So if you're going to repeat them, make sure that any poll question necessarily teases out the number of people who know who John Kerry is and know who George W. Bush is. Then you've got a mano a mano race. The warning sign for the president in all of these horse race polls is that even among those who don't particularly know who John Kerry is, they're voting for him. That's an anti-Bush vote, and that certainly is the kind of wake-up call I'm sure this White House and this re-election campaign is heeding.
Do you think he helped himself on that front yesterday, Kelly?
Pardon me?
Do you think he helped himself on that front yesterday?
Probably helped himself only in the fact that he engaged the press and he went out there and he sat in that chair and answered questions. I was surprised that neither the president nor Mr. Russert took more of the lead in changing the subject more often. I think the hour dragged on more than it needed to be, and I was dispirited that the president didn't lay out other parts of his legacy that maybe we the people need to be reminded of.
Well, that's a memo for the White House there. Kellyanne Conway, president of the Polling Company, thank you very much joining us tonight. We're talking tonight about the president on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday and how he did. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the president on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday and how he did, how Tim Russert did. You can join the conversation tonight. Was the president convincing on Iraq, on the economy, on his own military record? Did the self-ascribed label of war president, does it work for you? Does it elevate Bush or make him look evasive? And how did this incumbent candidate for the White House look? Invulnerable, in charge, in trouble? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by James Pinkerton, columnist at Newsday.com, Fox News contributor, and former White House aide to Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and by Joshua Micah Marshall, author of the daily blog TalkingPointsMemo.com. Let's listen to a little bit more of Tim Russert asking the president here if he has been a divider or a uniter.
This is Time Magazine. Love him or hate him. Why George Bush arouses such passion and what it means for the country.
Yes.
Tom Daschle, the Democratic leader in the Senate, said that you've changed the tone for the worse, that it's more acrimonious, more confrontations, that you are the most partisan political president he's ever worked with. Our exit polls of primary voters, not just Democrats, but independents in South Carolina, New Hampshire, more than 70% of them said they are angry or dissatisfied with you. And they point to this whole idea of being a uniter as opposed to a divider. Why do you think you are perceived as such a divider?
Gosh, I don't know, because I'm working hard to unite the country. As a matter of fact, it's the hardest part of being the president. I was successful as the governor of Texas for bringing people together for the common good, and I must tell you, it's tough here in Washington. And frankly, it's the biggest disappointment that I've had so far of coming to Washington. I'm not blaming anybody. It's just the environment here is such that it is difficult to find common ground. I'll give you a classic case, the Medicare bill. The Medicare bill was a tough vote, but the Medicare bill was a bill that a lot of people could have signed on to, and had it not been for kind of the sense, well, Bush might win, we might lose, or, you know, Bush might lose, we might win kind of attitude. But I'll continue to work hard to unite the country. I don't speak ill of anybody in the process here. I think if you went back and looked at my comments, you'd see that I don't attack. I don't hold up people. I talk about what I believe in.
President Bush asked if he's a divider or a uniter, and why. James Pinkerton, what do you hear in this answer? Is this a savvy, in-touch president who's elevating himself by saying, gosh, I don't want to get down in that muck, I don't believe I have been down in it, or something else?
I thought it was a very good answer, and I'm reminded of the way that Ronald Reagan would sort of kill Tip O'Neill with kindness back in the 80s, when O'Neill would be flailing away at Reagan as, you know, causing, you know, another return to Hooverism and so on, and Reagan would say, well, you know, we oppose each other till 6 o'clock, and after 6 p.m. we're friends.
Right. People
want that in a president. People don't really mind that, you know, you elect a Barney Frank or a Ted Kennedy to go out there and, you know, hack away at the opposition, but those guys never become president. For Bush to say, now, some, you know, if Bob Summerbee were still here, he might say, or for that matter, Josh, who writes a terrific blog on his own, Talking Points Memo, they'd say, look, Bush is a big fake. I mean, I'm not, you know, Bush is not actually dividing more than he's uniting. He's pushing an anti-gay marriage amendment. He's doing this. He's doing that. He's fighting the war in Iraq.
Yep.
But to watch him say that, oh, I'm wounded by this. I really want to unite people. I really want to work together. The American people love that. That's what they think a president who is, after all, the head of state, not just the leader of the Republican Party. That's what they think a president should do.
Let's pull in one more voice. Todd Lindbergh joins us from Washington. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's editor of Policy Review. Good evening and welcome, Todd Lindbergh.
Glad to be with you.
Thanks for being with us. Todd, what do you make of the president's answer on this point? I mean, the polarization of the American public is in poll after poll very clear. And yet, he says, I'm a uniter, not a divider. He's sticking with that in the broadcast yesterday. Is it persuasive, given the polarization we see in the polls?
Not to Democrats. Certainly it's not persuasive.
Well,
and I think the point about this is not to persuade Democrats that he is a uniter. I think the point is that that one should say one is a uniter, because that is something that people listening want to hear. It's very difficult to imagine a political candidate, for example, saying, you know, I really want to be partisan and nasty.
Right.
That's not how it works. So this is a message not designed, that is not essentially all that directly related to objective conditions in Washington, but rather to the way in which the president would like to be perceived in his approach.
Josh Marshall, what about the overall credibility factor here as you listened on the merits? Was the president giving what's the credibility ratio, you know, with your Geiger counter? How high?
Well, on this issue of polarization, I agree with Jim and Todd. I mean, this is, you know, I think the president's a divider, but I would think the president's a divider. I think what is not in his favor is that, going back to Jim's analogy with Ronald Reagan, what really hurt the Democrats profoundly under Ronald Reagan was that, even though Democrats really opposed a lot of his policies, a lot of swing voters and even a lot of Democrats liked him, just liked him as a
yep.
person. And it was very hard to get all but very partisan Democrats to really oppose him at a kind of a gut level.
But that hardly seems the case with George Bush.
Yeah, that's not at all the case with George Bush. I mean, Democrats really don't like the president, and I think that certainly applies to a lot of Democratic-leaning swing voters. So, we can, I guess, leave that. On the credibility issue, again, one's own political beliefs obviously color how one perceives these things. I mean, my sense is that the president has a few objective facts that really aren't on his side right now. The first being, on a couple of levels, the rationale for the war may have not panned out, and it really seems that he was at least fast and loose with the facts going into the war. The other is on fiscal policy. I believe there's over a $700 billion shift from a $200 billion surplus to half a trillion-dollar deficit over the last 3 years. Now, some of that's a downturn in the economy. Some of it is 9/11. But a lot of it is his policies. And I think on the credibility level, he really didn't address those two basic critiques of his policy.
But isn't he fundamentally sweeping those things aside and taking kind of the Teddy Roosevelt line here, I'm the man in the arena. I had to act. I'll stand up for security every time. Yes, that's going to have some costs attendant to it. Do you think, and of course it may not move the Democratic base, Josh, but it's all about the swing. We saw how closely divided the country was last time, maybe again. Do you think that's enough to bring in that swing margin to get the president what he wants, re-election?
I don't know, and I think that is the central question of this election, because what has kept the president very popular is, even though, I mean, there are a number of things that have been objectively wrong with the country over the last few years. The question is, who's to blame? I mean, obviously, the fiscal health of the country is not great. The economy up until fairly recently hasn't been that great. And what the president has had is that in all of these things, he could say, look, we had this national tragedy, which is not just a tragedy, but an attack on us. We're fighting back. These are hard times, but yeah, things aren't great, but that's because we're in a fight. And if he has that, he can say, look, sure, there's a big budget deficit, but there was 9/11, we're in a fight, these are tough times, et cetera. I think at the point at which 9/11 becomes unfastened from these other things that are happening in the country, he will be in very dire political trouble. And that I think, is really what this election is going to be about, whether 9/11 still is the linchpin for understanding the sort of the broad variety of things that are not in tip-top shape in the country.
Which my gut tells me may be an open question at this point, and the comments we've heard from John Edwards and others in the last few days indicates they might think the same. Dave is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hello. I wanted to comment on Tim Russert. I thought he was much too easy on Bush. And I thought that he could have, for instance, bored in on him on when he asked him about the budget. He could have asked him about how come his budget went up so much, or went up again.
Between the first estimate of 400-some billion to 500-plus billion.
Right.
The deficit.
Right. And his Medicare estimates went up. There's such a lack of credibility, it would seem to me, with President Bush, that there were many things that he could have followed up on instead of just passing on to the next question after President Bush gives him some long, evasive, as it was said earlier, filibustering answer.
Dave, would you have been offended if the interviewer, Tim Russert, asked tough follow-up questions in the Oval Office with the president, or do you think that's his job?
I think that's his job, and I think it's the president's job to be capable of answering them. And it doesn't seem to me that the president would have been capable of answering them.
Got it, Dave. Thanks very much for your call. George is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, George, you're on the line.
Good evening.
Hi.
I wanted to point out that I'm sure other people have noticed it, but this interview just brought it home to me, that the president thinks it's more important to make a decision than what the decision is. He kept referring to sitting behind that desk and being the president, and the decisions I made were more important. It sounded like, well, why do you care what the decision was? At least I made one.
Well, but it wasn't without substance. I mean, on the economy, he said, I cut taxes. That wasn't just a decision. It was a decision to cut taxes.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not denying that he said what his decisions are, but I don't know. Maybe it's an inferiority complex the man has, that he has to keep reminding everybody that he sits in the Oval Office.
And he,
I'm the president.
Yeah, and he
I have the big desk, and you don't.
Well, or he sits there, and he will step up, that kind of step-up, stand-up guy thing he's clearly going to. Todd Lindbergh, on that front, there have been Republicans criticizing the president today for not being assertive enough. How do you judge that?
I think Bush wanted some in this interview in particular.
Yes.
It seems to me that this is a kind of continuation in a way of the State of the Union address. I think what he was trying to do was clear away some of the accumulated underbrush, answer some of the charges that have been made against him, particularly by Democrats on the campaign trail. Yes, through a period in which he has not been especially visible, and in which obviously the objective conditions have not been especially favorable to him, namely, the continued absence of the WMD, and therefore the collapse of the most powerfully stated casus belli in Iraq.
Yep.
I think that when Bush starts thinking farther down the line in a couple of months, I think we'll get a different kind. We'd be surprised anyway if we didn't get a different kind of message out of him, one that is in a way more forward-looking and less backward-looking. Probably the calculation is that the WMD thing is a serious problem, but it won't. It won't be a problem forever, and as it happens, it is a lesser problem than the problem of what happens next in Iraq.
Let's hear one more bit from Tim Russert asking about John Kerry.
Two polls out this weekend show you...
See, there you're quoting polls.
You're trailing John Kerry in both the USA Today and Newsweek polls by 7 and 5 points.
Yeah.
This is what John Kerry had to say last year. He said that his colleagues are appalled at the, quote, president's lack of knowledge. They've managed him the same way they've managed Ronald Reagan. They send him out to the press for one event a day. They put him in a brown jacket and jeans and get him to move some hay or move a truck, and all of a sudden he's the Marlboro man. I know this guy. He was 2 years behind me at Yale. I knew him, and he's still the same guy.
Yeah.
Did you know him at Yale?
No.
How do you respond to that?
Politics. I mean, this is... if you close your eyes and listen carefully to what you just said, it sounds like the year 2000 all over again.
Did you know him, i.e. Kerry at Yale? No. Jim Pinkerton, can the president take that kind of, hey, I'm above that, it's just politics line, and win this year?
I think he'd be well advised to try, because I think that's what incumbent presidents do when they're running for re-election. And by the way, I can't resist commenting on Dave from Somerville's point.
Yes.
About it. Bush is putting a premium on making a decision right or wrong. I think that's exactly right. Bill Clinton, you may recall a while back, said that, Clinton being obviously critical of Bush, said that the American people would rather be strong and wrong than weak and right. And I think that's, again, where Bush doesn't need to sit there and discuss whether he can remember John Kerry at Yale. I mean, by many accounts, Bush was sort of a beer drinker at Yale anyway, so he might truly not remember him. But even if he did, I'd be inclined to tell him, look, just ignore the guy.
Because he can be strong and wrong, but strong wins.
And incumbents tend to get reelected.
Josh Marshall, what do you expect? The president going to be put up for more interviews like this? Or are they going to bring him back to speeches?
Oh, I would be very surprised if there's another interview like this in the next year. One thing I will agree with Peggy Noonan about, who wrote a column about the president's interview yesterday. This isn't his medium. This isn't his. This isn't where he shines. I expect to go back to speeches, and if they can manage it, they will keep him out of this kind of setting.
Todd Lindbergh, any doubt that that's the way we'll see him going forward?
I'm not even remotely sure that that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, it's actually been very interesting to be on the program tonight because I watched the debate. I am hearing excerpts from it.
Yep.
On radio. I think it actually plays very differently. Listening on the radio, I think you get a much less sort of stiff and stilted Bush. I mean, there's all that elaborate hand gesture,
right,
kind of activity. All that disappears. I go back to the debates with Gore. Bush was expected to get his clock cleaned by Gore in those debates. But and I don't think Bush, by the way, turned in exceptionally strong performances in them. But at the same time, he did have in mind what he wanted to do, which was to get a message out.
And he pulled it off. We're out of time, but a man not to be underestimated, Todd Lindbergh, Joshua Micah Marshall, James Pinkerton, thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.